I'd like now to welcome to the Radio Cafe Michelle Espy. She is a nuclear physicist. She's an R&D scientist at Los Alamos National Laboratory. And Al Urbaitis, he is an R&D engineer in the Applied Modern Physics Group at Los Alamos. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Hey. Hi, Mary Charlotte.
Great to have you here. Now, you guys work on practical applications of magnetic resonance imaging. First of all, what is MRI? Is there a way to explain it to our radio listeners?
Sure. So magnetic resonance imaging is a non-invasive imaging technology that takes advantage of the magnetic properties of the water in our bodies. Most MRI machines are based on a big magnetic field that aligns some very small fraction of the magnetic properties of the water in our body and then manipulates them to produce an image of what's going on inside the body, you know, without having to cut a person open and without having to use radiation.
And so water, one doesn't think of it as having magnetic properties, like being magnetic.
That's right. It's not magnetic in the sense that, you know, if you put a bar magnet, it would get attracted to it. The magnetic properties of water come from a nuclear spin. So water is made up of protons and neutrons, fundamentally everything is. And those protons and neutrons possess a property called nuclear spin. You can think of them like little tops, if you will, or bar magnets. And so that's the property that is exploited in magnetic resonance imaging.
What does magnetic resonance imaging show us that other kinds of like ultrasound and x-rays and things like that don't?
X-rays based on the transmission of radiation through the body, and so things that are more dense attenuate more than things that are less dense. So if you put a piece of film behind whatever it is you're taking an x-ray of, you know, the stuff that's thin for the x-rays appears bright and the stuff that's dense appears dark. And so it's a really good method for looking at things like bones. But x-rays less effective for looking at soft tissue, kind of the juicy stuff, because all that sort of has the same density. Magnetic resonance imaging, because it's based on these nuclear spin, that property is extremely sensitive to what's going on around it. It's not density-based, it's chemical, kind of chemistry-based. And so stuff that even might be pretty similar to an x-ray, like muscle and fat, looks real different because it's at that kind of atomic level.
And for some reason, it's really good at detecting, like, cancers.
That's right. That's right. Because the chemical property of the tumor tissue is different than that of, you know, fat or muscle.
Why is this research happening at LANL, which isn't primarily a medical research laboratory?
It's happening at LANL because we do magnetic resonance imaging in a way that's completely, completely different from how the medical community is doing it, and kind of a long and crazy road to get there. So our group does what's known as ultra-low field magnetic resonance imaging. So most MRI is done in a really big magnetic field.
Yeah, so big that, I mean, you see those disasters on YouTube where somebody turns it on and there's a fire hydrant in the room and it goes crashing into the machine or whatever.
That's right, that's right. The magnetic fields are measured in Tesla, and an MRI machine is typically, you know, above one Tesla. And for comparison, the Earth's magnetic field is 100,000 times smaller than that. And we do magnetic resonance at fields that are more comparable to the Earth's magnetic field. Part of the reason that we do that is because those systems, when you get away from that super high magnetic field, start to become more useful for applications where you could take them out into the real world. Like, you're never going to see an MRI machine going into a doctor's office because the field's too high, right? It has to be in a kind of special protected place. So a hospital can support one, but it'd be difficult for a doctor's office to support one because of the cost and complexity of that big magnetic field.
So when you have a high magnetic field MRI machine versus a low one, what is gained and lost in terms of efficacy in each machine?
So one of the first things that gets lost in a very low field machine is the total amount of signal that you can get from the material that you'll be looking at. Signal strength is proportional to the magnetic field that you can use. So the first thing that you lose is signal. One of the ways this program evolved is that the group we work with was looking at very, very, very small signals, and they were using a technology called superconducting quantum interference devices.
squid.
A squid is the correct term for that. So what we noticed is that with a squid and some manipulations of a flux transformer, you could take a look at neuronal signals directly. This is a field of probing that's called magnetoencephalography. So this has been done, and it's been shown that you could do this. The problem was is that people could not make squids work in very high density fields. If I excluded all the fields around your head and placed some squids in close proximity to it, I could pick up the neuronal activity in your brain. The problem is you can't do this. Well, what you couldn't do before was you couldn't put squids in high field intensity environments. So you had to figure out how is it that you could raise the field around these devices and yet preserve their operation. So you can do MRI at very low fields with very small signals, provided you have a signal detector that's sensitive enough to pick up what remains.
And so do these machines actually exist? Are they being used? You're building a prototype? Where are you at?
We have a few of these machines in our lab. We built a few machines that have actually come out of our lab and gone to airports and stuff. So they are deployable. You can move them around. And we've used these very low field MRI machines to do a bunch of stuff. We've, of course, done a lot of brain imaging with them. We've shown that you can combine this ultra-low field imaging method with the magnetoencephalography method that Al was describing. And that's kind of nice because then you can get both an anatomical picture of the brain and a functional picture of the brain based on neural activity at the same time. You know, we've used these MRI machines for detecting explosives or characterizing different kinds of materials. And now most recently we've been trying to show that this might be a path towards MRI machines that can go out into the world to emergency response for, you know, conditions or rural settings where they can't support the infrastructure of a high-field MRI machine. And so that's really what we've been focused on most recently.
A few years ago, there were attempts to use this technology, I guess, from your group, in airport security?
That's right. So at the time that we had started working on the combination of MRI with magnetoencephalography for functional brain imaging, that was 2006. And that was the same year that there was a thwarted terrorist plot to use liquid explosives to disrupt transatlantic flights from the UK to the US. And that was when we first got the travel restriction on liquids aboard aircraft.
Which is why they take away your peanut butter when you go through.
There's no liquids and gels. And yeah. And the reason for that is kind of what we were talking about earlier with the difference between X-ray and MRI. X-ray is very good at density contrast. Most liquids and gels don't have very much density difference. So an X-ray machine isn't so good at telling the airport screener what that liquid actually is. So they just don't let you have very much.
So with MRI, it actually does tell you what the liquid is?
Yeah, MRI can tell you what the liquid is, or at least what class the liquid belongs to. But then you get back to that problem. You can't put a high-field MRI machine in an airport, right? It's going to be sucking people's car keys across.
Yeah, and their knee replacements.
That's right. So you don't want that. So we got asked to just do a little demo to see if maybe this ultra-low-field MRI would be possible for an airport because the fields are very low, so you don't have those problems with the attraction of metal objects or disrupting people. And so that was a project we worked on for a long time, was developing this technology, and we had several installations at the Albuquerque Sunport that showed, you know, that this approach was pretty effective, actually.
So what would it detect? Like, when would your sensor go off and say, okay, this is not contact lens solution?
So we had a big database of materials, both benign and threat, and so we kind of developed a space, if you will, where stuff that was shampoo, you know, was kind of in one part of the space, and stuff that was, you know, not shampoo, was an explosive, lived in a different part of the space. And so then that was the method, you know, you run a bottle through, and it was nice because you could use a closed bottle. It worked through a soda can. I mean, it was pretty robust. And if something showed up, you know, in the space that was close to threat material versus benign material, that would alarm the system.
So if I were carrying paint thinner in a shampoo bottle,
that's
it would go off.
Yeah, it would go off.
So how come they didn't get to be? What about drugs? Like if you were taking liquid cannabis or something through, would it set those things off, or was it really only?
We focused on explosives, so I have reasons to think that the threat space could have been expanded, but that wasn't what we were looking for. We were interested in explosives.
We did examine alcohols though, and what we found is that we could readily detect the differences between reds and whites, between whiskeys and tequila. And that, believe it or not, is actually kind of a sidebar application of this sort of thing. Throughout the developed world, there's a market for counterfeits, right? So anything that's gone to high value, say a bottle of wine, there's a temptation to misrepresent that. And so people will get a period correct bottle, make a period correct label, and they'll promote this as, oh yeah, this is a 1953 Chateau Lafite Rothschild original.
And really they poured something from a box from Trader Joe's
That's
into
right.
it and corked it up.
But not to disparage Trader Joe's. I'm sure their box wine is...
it actually is pretty good.
but nevertheless, is that because you can readily compare true vintages from false ones, you can tell what's in the bottle without opening the bottle.
That's amazing.
Yeah, it was a really sensitive technique. Now, the one thing they wouldn't let us do as part of our study was actually see if we could tell if there was a correlation between what we measured and taste.
Exactly.
So we haven't done that exercise yet, but...
Yeah, right. Let's just not put the sommeliers out of business just yet.
But yeah, it was a very sensitive technique, and it could tell the difference between different, you know, even different classes of the same beverage.
Very, very interesting. So how come it hasn't gone into actual use? It would be awfully nice if it did, because then we wouldn't have to worry about packing our liquids into the check-in luggage.
That's right. I think there's still some, I think the Department of Homeland Security still has some motivation to eliminate that restriction. I mean, they know no one likes it. But, you know, the funding for actual R&D science that the Department of Homeland Security has is very, very limited. They don't actually get an opportunity to fund a lot of R&D science. And unfortunately, events moved on and they just decided that liquids weren't their biggest problem right now.
It's always been, I mean, we're getting a little off subject here, but it's always been a little strange to me that you can't bring a like half-empty jar of peanut butter through, but you can buy a full jar on the other side.
Yeah, I know, for a much higher price.
Yeah.
So, yeah, yeah.
Anyway.
I won't comment on that.
But moving right along, we're talking to Michelle Espy and Al Urbaitis about magnetic resonance imaging. So this is a technology that, I mean, what are your hopes for the way it could be used?
Well, I think one of the things we really hope is that it would make MRI more accessible as a medical diagnostic, and maybe as an industrial or security diagnostic too. Part of the problem with MRI is it's an extremely high-tech, expensive kind of first-world technology, and most people in the world won't ever get an opportunity to have an MRI, even if they need one, because it's just too expensive. And I think one of the hopes we have is that this would make a methodology that would be available to more people. You know, in the country of Uganda, I have a colleague who does hydrocephalus treatment on children there. There's not a single MRI machine.
In the entire nation?
In the entire nation.
Wow.
They use CT, a computer tomography, which is a good technique. It's an x-ray-based technique, and repeated... A repeated CT to the head of an infant is not really what you want to be doing.
Yeah, yeah.
And so there's a space, I think, for making MRI available to more people.
You know, there was an interesting story several years ago when we look at the different ways that countries do their health insurance and set their prices and negotiate prices on health procedures. Japan has like a blue book, and every single medical procedure has a price, and that's what doctors have to charge. They can't charge a penny above that or a yen above that. And they set the price for MRIs really low, like $100. And the doctor's like, we can't afford to do these. And so they put a lot of pressure on the equipment manufacturers, and they started producing these low-priced less fancy, but apparently just as good MRI machines. Have you come in contact with those Japanese lower-priced MRIs?
I'm more familiar with the American market as opposed to the foreign markets. One of the things that happened over the last 25 years is that MRI imaging was focused on getting a better picture and to try to expand its utility. So one of the things that from when we started doing MRI in the United States, I had the experience of constructing an apparatus, and it passed its commissioning tests and whatnot. And they gave me a call, and they said, "Oh, gee whiz, Alan, you have to come down and have a look." And so I came down, and they showed me this image, and they said, "Al, can you tell if this guy's alive or dead?" And I said, "No, I can't." And everybody had a big laugh, because here we had $1 million worth of hardware, and yet they had stuck a cadaver in there for their commissioning test. But they all laughed because I couldn't tell whether or not it was alive or dead. Looking more closely, eventually, I believe I could have told, because there was a telltale artifact that was missing, which was blood flow.
Right.
But that's usually considered to be in those days, that was considered to be an error in the image, meaning that it wasn't successfully taken care of. But so the focus for the last 25 years was to decide whether or not it was one good thing to tell if the tissue is there, whether or not the tissue has the correct geometry, whether or not it's symmetrical. But it's also very important to figure out, is the tissue functioning properly? So if you take a look at the history of imaging, almost always that's the next thing that people wanted to do. Driving it to be really cheap is sort of the last thing that you try to do. Because, first of all, you want to know if you can do this. And you don't want to miss a utility that's extremely valuable. So, think of like heart imaging. We used to take, well, you still do this, but we lay a person down, we enter the femoral artery, we inject a dye, and we film the operation of the heart as the dye enters the heart, right? So this kind of angiography you can do with MRI in the absence of these dyes. So you can say a lot about the function of a heart without actually putting an extra hole in the patient. And that's the sort of thing you really want to avoid. For the most part, putting an extra hole in your body is never really a good idea.
Right.
And so that's what physicians would like to avoid. They would like to say something conclusive before they resort to putting extra holes in people.
So the fact that you didn't know the difference between a living and a dead body means that temperature really doesn't play a role.
Within a normal range of temperature, it doesn't play much of a role. If you freeze things, then, in fact, it does play a significant role. You can actually tell stuff that's not room temperature. But the difference between, say, 50 degrees and, say, 100 degrees, the differences are very subtle, and you have to have a clue that you're looking for this now.
So if you had somebody who had actually died of cancer and their body temperature had dropped and they still had the tumor, the MRI would show it as if it were a living person?
There would be very little difference in the imaging, unless you pre-selected the imaging sequence to tell you precisely that. And that's usually not what you do. In other words, to image cancerous tissue, you select sequences so that in the area that you suspect that the tumor exists, that you would create contrast between the tumor and the adjacent healthy tissue. So that's what you would pre-select the sequence to do, to allow that to be the most significant aspect of the image. So in the event that I wanted to tell if somebody's alive or dead, I would pre-select the sequence to show either respiratory motion or blood flow or CSF flow.
Right, and you'd probably use a less expensive technique, their heart.
Or ask them.
See if it's beating.
If they feel okay. But I think just a couple things. You know, one of the things Al said, sequence, is the way you manipulate the magnetic fields in the MRI machine to get the picture. And that's one of the cool things about MRI, is that you can really play around with that to, you know, highlight differences between tissue, or you know, the difference between voids and full space, or just the difference between, you know, whether or not there's a lot of water or less water. I mean, you have a lot of flexibility in an MRI machine to do that kind of stuff. And so I think in this country, the focus has really been on kind of pushing the technology and making the pictures better and better. And I don't think we've really adopted that philosophy you were talking about of the Japanese of trying to drive the cost down. I mean, in our country, we have the luxury that your doctor is always going to want you to go to the most expensive machine to get the absolute best picture. I think it's kind of a mindset change to say, you know what, it's okay if the picture isn't perfect or the best picture I can get. I'm going for good enough now. That's different than how I think it's done in this country.
Yeah, and it's also, I mean, what would be, like in Japan, there are actually drivers built into the system to push that kind of innovation, even if the picture isn't any worse. We don't have those drivers
have it,
here.
Yeah.
Well, there's also a reasonable analogy between medical imaging and photography. So what, for this afternoon, your cell phone's camera may be entirely adequate, and in fact, you could probably do some artistic work with a recently developed a cell phone camera. But if what you're going to do is take an archival portrait, you'll probably go to a professional photographer. And the professional photographer probably does have a hot rod camera, and he probably does have reasons to use it. You know, right now, there's an exciting trend in videography, of taking videos with available cell phone cameras. But if you're going to do a blockbuster or photograph a New Mexico sunset, you want some real gear to go do this.
Right, right.
But that said, the title of the project that we're working on right now is called Battlefield MRI, and that, I think that's an application where people would accept a less good picture, because right now there's no picture at all.
I mean, Battlefield MRI, I'm sorry, it does sound like an oxymoron.
It does, right? So, you know, when we were building these MRI machines for the airport, one of the things that just, you know, all of us thought was, wow, this is like the first MRI machine we've ever seen that could just be picked up with a forklift, moved around. You can completely disengage the magnetic field. In a high-field MRI machine, the big field's always there, unless something's gone wrong, like in one of those YouTube videos. In our case, we can just turn that field off at will. We can point it in any direction we want. I mean, we have tons of flexibility, and actually, with the exception of the shielded structure that some of these operate in, it's pretty small. You know, it's almost like, you know, the IKEA MRI machine that you could just put together with an Allen wrench, right? I say that because Al's done all the engineering to make that happen. And so as we were building these MRI machines in the airport, we kept thinking, gosh, this is like the little MRI machine. This is pretty cool. And that was kind of where the idea for Battlefield MRI came from, was, you know, we realized in our combat support hospitals, despite the preponderance of traumatic brain injury that we're seeing in recent conflicts, there's no MRI because they can't have it. It's too expensive. It's too hard to move around. They can't support it. Guys show up with injuries. They may or may not have metal in their body. You're never going to put them in a big magnetic field.
Yeah, I mean, if they have
shrapnel, you'll kill them. Yeah, you could make it a lot worse. In our case, the fields aren't strong enough to put those kinds of forces on metal, and so it's a metal-friendly technique. And so that just is a lot of opportunity space to develop MRI for those situations.
But we're not quite there yet.
We're not quite there yet because one of the things that we've always enjoyed in our R&D environment was the opportunity to control the magnetic field environment. When your fields are comparable to the Earth's magnetic field, you're competing with the Earth's magnetic field and absolutely every other magnetic thing around. So if someone drove a pickup truck up next to your MRI machine, you know, you're going to have a problem because that thing's producing magnetic fields too. And so now that we've established that we can image at these weak fields, the next step is to show that we can control the environment well enough. And so we've just started to have success with what we call field compensation. You know, we put a few big coils around the system, and pretty much try to cancel out, you know, measure and cancel the fields around us, so that our MRI is being done in fields that we understand.
Well, very interesting, and we will perhaps follow this as it progresses over the years. I want to thank you both for being with us, Michelle Espy, nuclear physicist, Al Urbaitis, R&D engineer in the Applied Modern Physics Group at Los Alamos National Laboratory. Thank you both so much for being with us on the Radio Cafe.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you, Mary Charlotte. It's a pleasure to meet you.